This is a Triple J podcast.
Hack. Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. If you live with ADHD, you're probably familiar with the stress and cost of finding support, getting a diagnosis, figuring out which meds work for you. Imagine you've been through all that. You've finally settled on a dose of a medication that you're happy with, and then all of a sudden it's not available. You can't get it anywhere. Your world's thrown into chaos. Well, that has been the experience of a lot of Australians. They're dealing with that right now because there's a shortage. So we're going to be explaining later in this podcast why there's been this ADHD medication crisis, when it's expected to ease. Also coming up, a heap of buzz around Australia's newest AFL club, the Tasmania Devils. Not everyone's happy though. Is this fight over a football team going to affect Tasmania's election this weekend? We'll find out. First though,
pack.
There is only two scales of heat that we have. One is it's hot and one is it's hot as f-
on Triple J.
How hot does your place get? If you're in an older place, bad insulation, no aircon, do you sometimes walk outside and think it is actually hotter inside than it is out here in the sun? But to be honest, there's not much you can do about it if you're renting. Maybe you go hang out with your family, you stay at work a bit longer where it's cooler. Some research out today shows heaps of renters across the country spent the summer in homes that reached unhealthy and even dangerous temperatures. If you've been through this, I'm sure it's not surprising, but I'm wondering if you can describe to me how bad your situation is. How suffocating was the heat at your place? Call in 1300 055536. You can message in too, 0439757555. Hack reporter Ellie Grounds has been meeting some young renters who really feel like they've hit boiling point.
In summer, it honestly gets so hot that the only way of resting during the day is passing out from the heat. It gets that extreme that there's no escaping it. It's a real risk to physical health.
25-year-old Sam lives in a share house in Brisbane. It's a cute Queenslander with a huge backyard, the stuff of dreams for many young renters. But in summer, it becomes pretty much unlivable.
At all times, inside my bedroom, whether I've got all my fans on, windows open, doors open, it's always consistently at least 4 or 5 degrees hotter than outside. The best solution we have is just to drench ourselves and then stand like a wet fish in front of our pedestal fan and just like pray that somehow the wind is gonna cool us off just for those 5 minutes, and then suddenly you're back into that heat again.
Sam's place doesn't have aircon in the common areas or in his bedroom, which made getting the rest he needed to recover from a road accident basically impossible.
And then it would just be a case of me lying there for the 10 hours and just suffering through this excruciating, hellish heat. Especially with someone that has chronic pain, it means that I'm unable to get to like a deep sleep because I'm constantly having to move and adjust and try and get the fan on different parts of my body. And so it's making my pain a lot worse.
Sam's house is one of 109 rental properties across the country that had their temperature and humidity tracked over summer by the advocacy group Better Renting.
It's really clear that a lot of these homes, these rental homes, are basically way too hot for the greater part of the summer.
Joel Dignam is Better Renting's executive director.
So on average across Australia, the median temperature is just under 25 degrees Celsius. So people are spending up 50% of the time above that. And that's really not a place you want to be spending much time at all.
No, it's not, at least according to guidelines from the World Health Organization. Its recommended safe range for indoor temperatures is 18 to 24 degrees. And Better Renting's temperature tracking project found that in 4 states or territories, the median temperature recorded by the renters was above that over summer. Half the time, the rentals in the Northern Territory were above 28.9 degrees. And it was above the safe range in WA and New South Wales too. In Queensland, the median temperature was 28.2 degrees, and that state was also the worst place to be indoors.
We tracked outdoor temperatures, and you can actually see people are hotter indoors than out for about one third of the time on average. And in Queensland, that gets up to almost two thirds of the time.
But what alarms Joel Dignam the most is how hot the nights were.
It's basically as hot overnight as it is through the rest of the day. So people aren't getting that respite. The homes aren't getting a chance to cool down. And in terms of the health risks from heat, particularly from heat waves, that's really a red flag for us.
One renter said their home was so hot that in the past they've had to sleep in a tent in their backyard. Another was forced to call an ambulance after their body just couldn't cool down and it became a health emergency. Others who are lucky enough to have some aircon say being forced to use and pay for it every day takes a toll on their mental health.
I don't like being reminded of the existing climate crisis inside my house every day. We shouldn't have to choose between being comfortable at home and whether we're going to be able to afford the power bill.
Cara and her partner Matt have whole rooms in their house that, in summer, are off limits.
I have an office room upstairs that I can't use because it just stores all the heat and the ceiling fan just doesn't cut it.
That office space next to their bedroom is where they've kept their temperature tracker.
You can see it's already gone up to 30.4 at about 72% humidity. And it is about 10 to 10 at the moment. The highest temperature that we've had in here has been 36.6 in this room.
So what's the answer? Well, Joel Dignam wants minimum energy performance standards to be introduced for rental properties nationally.
You can require things like ceiling insulation, so renters aren't cooking from above, and cooling appliances. They have ways, affordable ways to cool their homes down once they get hot.
And he wants to see that happen fast.
What we're seeing is that the existing rental housing stock is barely coping with the summers that we're currently having. And this is increasingly going to be a very straightforward issue of will people live through heat waves?
Hack on Triple J.
Ellie Grounds with that story, hearing from you loud and clear on the text line. Someone says our rentals averaged over 35 almost every day this summer and is over 30 by 10 a.m. The owner cut down our only shade. Even when we begged them not to, the house is tin and glass and intolerable during summer. M from Melbourne says, I'm in an apartment in Hawthorne and there's one window and no aircon. The property manager refuses to talk to me about it. I have to go to friends' houses or sleep with a wet towel on me in front of the fan. Someone else, I remember renting a house years ago that got so hot that my bath salts melted and seeped out of the bag. What? It's a lot of stories here. Another person accusing people of being woke for getting hot in their houses. I don't know what that one means. Let's go to someone on the line though. Now, Chantelle is calling in from Sydney. Chantelle, have you battled a hot rental before?
I have, yeah. So when I first did the inspection on the place, I was aware that the shutter in the lounge room was broken, like it was stuck in an up position. And I was told by real estate and everything that that was going to get fixed, which it never did. So I was in the place for about a year. So during the day, I didn't get like the direct sun coming in, but it came quite strongly through. About midday to 3 or 4 p.m. So during the peak of summer when it's like 35 degree day,
yeah. The
inside of the place wasn't too hot. I'll grant it that. But then at night time, it was like all that heat stored up and it stayed. So it was averaging like 25 degrees at night to 28 degrees sort of around that at night.
The worst time at night when you're trying to sleep.
No ceiling fans, no air conditioning. I had a pedestal fan that I'd bought that I would literally like mist water onto myself and hope that fan would sort of hit me and it would cool me down. It was just horrendous.
Chantelle, that sounds so awful. So a lot of people have the same experience as you. They're writing in now with their experiences. Someone says, I'm a teacher and I go to work on weekends just to be in the AC on hot days. Like, it's ridiculous what people are experiencing. Hey, Chantelle.
I was just going to say the worst part of it is when I left the place, the real estate noticed how many people were looking to actually take over and go there. They increased the rent on the place up by $100 and everyone in the building by $100 on my left.
Oh, not surprising, yeah. I think it's fair to say. Hey, Chantelle, thank you so much for calling in with your experience. Like I said, hearing so many very similar stories on the text line now. I want to get into this a bit more with Emma Baker, who's a professor of housing research at the University of Adelaide. She's been looking into all of this and she's with us now. Hey, Emma, thanks for coming on Hack.
Nice to speak to you.
How big of a problem is housing temperature, heating, cooling, all of that kind of stuff in rentals?
If you went back 5, 10, 15 years, nobody would have been talking about this. But it's actually this huge problem that's just kind of bubbled up from under the surface. So We've been doing some monitoring over the last few years, and it's a much bigger problem than you'd imagine.
It's not just hothouses, is it? It's cold ones as well. Like, it's right across the board.
Yeah, look, in Australia, we build, historically built, basically tents, and they look great, but they're terrible to heat and cool. And I suppose we've always built them like that because it was really cheap to heat and cool them. And only recently has it become very expensive to heat and cool. So now we're really beginning to think about how expensive our heating and cooling is and how we warm our houses.
What kind of impact is it having on people's lives? Because, you know, it might seem like nothing for people listening, like, oh, yeah, sometimes my house gets a bit hot, I have to get out of it for a few hours, or, yeah, it's cold, but I rug up, that kind of thing. But can you explain what kind of impact it's having on people's lives?
I suppose, I mean, there's a whole gamut of effects, but in terms of the very pointy end of health, can you imagine the drudgery of living in a house that you just can't keep warm enough to keep the mold at bay? If you're trying to keep your kids warm and not breathing in mold, that becomes, you know, there's a mental health effect of that, but there's also a physical health effect of that. And I guess at the other end of the spectrum, you just have the worry of being able to afford your power bills at the end of the 3 month or 1 month period when they come in.
Do you think it's the case that people have just grown so used to it that they don't know any different, that we expect that this is going to be the case, especially for rentals?
Look, I think in the old days there was this suck it up, put a jumper on, put a hat on, get a water bottle and it'll be fine. And that used to kind of get us through. We've now reached the stage where many people just aren't warming their houses or cooling their houses to a safe and healthy temperature. It was invisible before and it wasn't captured in our planning system. It wasn't really a consideration. We ran a series of focus groups with housing providers, social housing providers, looking at energy poverty and keeping houses warm and cool. And one social housing provider had put air conditioners into people's houses, which sounds like a brilliant idea. But then 6 months later, they had this massive after effect of bill shock. So everyone had made their house a healthy temperature and then were suffering probably even more effects of the worry of never being able to pay their electricity bill.
What are the standards that are in place? Are there any standards across the country? And if so, yeah, what are they?
Australia, if you think about it, what's behind your front door in Australian culture is your business. So in a way, we don't really have standards for, you know, a house after it's been built. So we have an Australian building code, which someone famously said is a list of the worst possible housing that you're legally allowed to build. So we have this building code that guides the new houses that are built. So that's about 2% of our stock every year. So 98% of the stock, we really have almost no idea of how warm or cool it is, how well it performs. It's probably important to say across the housing system, there's hot and cold houses in home-owned sector as well as the rental sector. And sometimes the worst housing that we see for temperature is actually, you know, older homeowners who've lived there for 50 years. But in the rental sector, we also see some, you know, we see a wide variety, some very, very good housing and some really, really poor condition housing without the infrastructure to heat or cool. So there's a wide variety. And we see, for example, we did a study last year which showed that nearly 80% of Australian homes never got to healthy winter temperature during winter.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese speaking with housing expert Emma Baker about the temperature in your house. Maybe you're renting or maybe you own the place. It's too hot, it's too cold. On the text line, someone says, my timber cottage in Newcastle had an internal temp of 46 degrees in February for a couple of days. I was having 10 cold showers a night. Another person says, one hot day, a picture fell off the wall because the heat made the hook fail. I was lying on the ground in my swimmers trying to avoid the heat, did not die. Oh, thank goodness. They also say, I think people can just buy a fan and pop a wet towel over it or open the window. Someone says, toughen up. I think this generation's weak, is someone's opinion. And then someone else says, what about homeowners? I bought a house 2 years ago with aircon, and unfortunately, because of the design, our bedroom is still 32 degrees late at night. Harden up or give us all aircon. I am speaking with Emma Baker, housing expert, about this issue. Emma, why do you think there hasn't been more action on this? Like, politicians haven't moved, brought in more policies in this area?
I should say I'm quite optimistic. I think there hasn't been action because it's sort of been an invisible problem. But in the last few years, it's almost like the stars have aligned and Australia has realised that the rental sector is likely to be the place that many, many Australians will live in for their whole life. So, you know, it's kind of moved from being a tenure where, you know, you probably rented for a little bit while you're saving up for a home and then you moved into home ownership. So it was almost like a temporary transit tenure. But now they're realising that a lot of Australians are going to be living in rental for life. So why don't we try and make it somewhere that people want to live and can live happily for life? So what this has really caused in government side is much more of an interest in trying to look at the rental sector and make it a better place to live. So there's gradual improvements in standards in the rental sector.
What do you think we need to be seeing then?
Well, I suppose in Australia, what we could do to start with is start building houses that are good in the first place. And if you were to look at the population at the moment who have houses that are too hot or too cold, it takes a long time to change the infrastructure to improve things for them. But you could give them a bonus to pay for a bit more power until we can sort it out. So I think in the short term, we might need to throw a little bit of money at this until we can do some longer term, you know, more well thought out things like incentivizing landlords to provide better quality houses, you know, with more efficient air conditioning and heating and better insulation. You know, there's a variety of things that we could do.
What are other countries doing to tackle this issue? And I, you know, note that every country has its own very unique circumstances when it comes to weather, temperatures. But is there a country overseas we should be looking at for maybe some guidance on this area?
Do you know, I think New Zealand is probably the perfect place to look, mainly because they have this really sensible approach to looking at, you know, the relationship between people's housing and their health. So what they've done is they've systematically gone through the literature, worked out which bits of housing have an effect on health, and then they've drawn up basically housing policy that's designed to improve people's health. So where they end up within that is a rental standard of fitness, which is now being instituted in New Zealand, which has a series of things, almost like in New South Wales, if you need to get your car registered, you take it in and get a pink slip. So in the rental sector, they're instituting basically a pink slip for the rental sector.
That's so interesting. Wow. And it's something that people might not have even thought about. There's so many issues, Emma, in the rental market at the moment, whether it's exorbitant cost of renting in general or eviction rules or any number of kind of rules, regulations. Realistically, how likely is it that we're going to see action on this issue, that it will be a priority moving forward?
Oh, no, I think we're already seeing action on the issue. It's a difficult problem to nut out because there's so many private landlords. It's not like someone owns the whole rental stock and we can just fix it that way. We've got a really dispersed rental ownership system, so we need to be a little bit more clever about it. But there's definitely movement afoot in trying to regulate the rental sector so it is a better place to live.
We appreciate your take on all of this. Emma Baker from the University of Adelaide, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
Lovely to talk to you.
And still so many messages coming through on Instagram. Someone backing up what Emma's just said, saying cars need a roadworthy certificate before being sold. Rentals should have a rentworthy certificate before they're rented.
Hack.
The Devil Army now needs to fight even harder.
On Triple J.
Yeah, we're ready for the Devils. Tassie's AFLW team now have a name. They've got the colours, the logo, the jersey. More than 75,000 people have already signed up as members. It's not all celebrations, though, because at the moment the team still doesn't have a dedicated venue to play, and the future of the new footy stadium in Tasmania is dependent on who wins the state election this weekend. It's been a really controversial issue. And our Tassie reporter April McLennan's been looking into it.
The one thing that defines this team is people. Proud people. our people. People who've spent a century always kicking into the wind until today, when the team we were told would never, ever happen roars to life.
It's been a long time coming.
3, 2, 1. The name of your football club, Tasmania Devils.
Aussie rules footy has been played in Tassie for about 150 years. And over all that time, the state's never had its own team in the national comp. But all that changed last night, with the Tasmania Devils team officially launched. The club's colours will be green, yellow and red, while the club's jumper has a map of the state with a T in the middle. Now we have a name, logo and a jumper, but the team still doesn't have anywhere to play. So to give you a bit of context here, Tassie was given the 19th AFL licence in a deal signed between the state government and AFL last year, but that's conditional on a new 23,000-seat stadium being built on Hobart's waterfront. So basically, if Tassie doesn't build a new stadium, then they can't play in the National League. And AFL CEO Andrew Dillon says the new stadium is vital for the success of the club.
Business case that was put to the AFL Commission was had the stadium as a centrepiece, so that was a really important part of the approval that was given, and our 18 clubs agreed with that.
In the club's first season in 2028, the Tasmanian team will play its home games at existing ovals in Hobart and Launceston, while the new stadium is presumably being built. For every season after that, the Tassie government must pay the club $4.5 million of taxpayer money if the stadium isn't ready. Here's Andrew again.
What's really important for us is that the club can be competitive and successful from day one, and the stadium is so important for that. So the licence is conditional on the stadium, but well, I know we'll be able to work with both sides of politics, both sides of government, and we'll get it done.
Wait, why is he saying that last bit? Well, the Tassie AFL team has become a bit of a political football.
What does Tassie want?
No stadium!
Then stick your stadium up your bum!
And that's because of the hefty price tag, a whopping $750 million. The federal government committed $240 million. The state Liberal Party says it's going to chuck in $375 million. And the AFL says it will kick in $150 million towards the project. But then it gets tricky. The Greens hate the deal, while the state Labor leader Rebecca White wants to renegotiate it. And that's important here, because she's trying to get elected Premier this weekend.
I'm not convinced that Tasmanian taxpayers should need to fund a billion-dollar stadium in Hobart.
And while a lot of Taswegians do want their own team, people are genuinely split over the stadium idea, because some people think the money could be better spent elsewhere.
I'm not going to bother about whatever the Liberal Party say here. If they are listening to Tasmanians, they will be hearing that the main issue Tasmanians care about are cost of living, health and housing.
So while the club may have been launched, the path to the stadium remains a challenge for the government and potentially the AFL. Here's Liberal leader Jeremy Rockcliffe.
Last night was a historic moment for all Tasmanians and lovers of footy. And if people, Tasmanian people, want the AFL team and want the dream to continue, they have to vote Liberal 1-7 on Saturday. This is about the young people of Tasmania. It's not about me as Premier. It's about the aspiration of our boys and girls living out their dream, playing in their own colours.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, April McLennan with that story on Instagram. Dan says it's a joke spending billions on a stadium instead of improving hospitals, improving young people's future and on climate change. And then someone else says, great to see Tasmania joining the AFL. Terrible jersey, though.
Hack.
Today's rant, how difficult it is with ADHD medication and getting it in Australia.
On Triple J.
If you live with ADHD, you'll know how life-changing medication can be. It can really improve your situation, make things a lot easier. Which is why a massive global shortage of one of ADHD's most popular medications has had huge flow-on effects around the world. It's been dragging on for months. So how long will it last? Shalala Madora's been looking into it.
So I was diagnosed at the end of 2021 and I originally started with dexamphetamines instead.
This is someone we'll call Grace from the Gold Coast.
She tried different medication for her ADHD before going on Vyvanse in November last year. She says it's been a game changer.
It's crazy to feel that, like, the little voices and the noise that you're constantly surrounded with just disappears, and you're able to do those daily tasks that everyone can do.
But recently, Grace has really been struggling to find this game changer medication.
When I filled my last script, I spent a whole afternoon. I called close to 100 different pharmacies through the Gold Coast area, through the Brisbane area.
Some pharmacists were really rude and hung up on Grace. Others tried to help and directed her to other stores that might have some.
She kind of joked with me. She's like, hey, if you're driving to Tamworth, that's where our closest supply is. That would have to be close to 8 hours from the Gold Coast area.
In December of last year, the drug regulator, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, or TGA, announced a global shortage of Vyvanse. Here's what a spokesperson for the TGA told us in a statement.
There is currently a global shortage of ADHD medication Vyvanse 30 milligrams, 40 milligrams and 60 milligram capsules. These shortages are due to manufacturing issues compounded by increased demand.
The way the prescriptions are made for Vyvanse is somewhat different to other medications.
Dr. Ashtar Toma is the head of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. She says rules around how Vyvanse is prescribed and dispensed make it that much harder to get your hands on it.
So let's say, for example, I make a prescription of 60 milligrams and then they go to their pharmacy. The pharmacy would say possibly that we don't have supply of 60 milligrams, but we do have a supply of 40 milligrams and 20 milligrams. But then the pharmacist is not able to dispense 40 milligrams plus 20 milligrams to make it 60 milligrams.
In other words, pharmacists don't have the flexibility to dispense anything except exactly what's on the script.
Which then means that the person or the patient has to go back to the psychiatrist and say, can you make a new prescription?
Putting aside how hard it can be to get an appointment in the first place, seeing a psychiatrist is expensive.
You have to pay $400 to get a script, and then, you can't fill that script. You have to go back and pay another $400 to get a new script.
The College of Psychiatrists wants the federal government to urgently change the rules.
I think the government, as a short-term measure, can look at ways there are restrictions on those prescriptions and how can we facilitate that.
Federal Health Minister Mark Butler said he understood that the shortage was causing deep distress in the public. He told Hack that Vyvanse is a Schedule 8 restricted medicine, which means it's tightly controlled due to the risk of addiction. The TGA expects the shortage on some dosages of Vyvanse to ease by the end of this month and to fully resume back to normal at the end of April. But a spokesperson warned,
medicine shortages are dynamic and information can change.
They said the best thing to do if you're worried is to keep checking the TGA's website for updated info. As for Grace, well, she was able to use an older script from her psychiatrist for 20 milligrams of Vyvanse that she had when she was trying out different dosages. It's still not going to stretch very far.
I probably only have enough now until mid-April.
She feels lucky to have that and anxious about what comes next.
I feel so fortunate to still have stock to this stage, but there's so many people who have just really just been, thrown out to sea almost.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Medora with that story. And on the text line, messages coming through, someone says, I'm so glad I changed back to Ritalin just before the Vyvanse shortage started. I'm bad enough when I'm on meds. I don't know if I'd cope at all without them. Kelly in Melbourne says, my psychiatrist warned me about the ADHD medication shortages when I was diagnosed earlier this year. It hasn't affected me yet, but it's definitely feeding into anxiety about what I will do if I can't get what I need. And someone else says, my psych wants me to switch to Vyvanse from Ritalin because it's begun to cause me anxiety, but she can't do it because of the shortage. So yeah, a lot of people are really upset about this. It's impacting their daily life. We're going to stay on top of it. Hopefully, as we heard, this shortage is going to ease in the weeks ahead, but we'll make sure we do keep you across it. That's all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you next time. Hack.